This is David Rovix, and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step 3 is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
Welcome to the Climate Action Radio Show, which can be heard on community radio at 3CR in Melbourne and Skid Row in Sydney. My name is Vivian Langford, and salut Babette. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and pay tribute to the decades-long legacy of Aboriginal fights for land rights and against the destructive mining projects that are fueling climate change. In particular, we acknowledge the Wangan and Jagalingu cultural custodians and their ongoing opposition to coal mining on their lands in central Queensland, and to the Gomeroi traditional custodians' continuing opposition to coal and gas on their land in New South Wales. It is vital at this late stage in history that we all learn to care for country. It will always be Aboriginal land, and now is our time to all stand up for and protect it.
Tonight we're going to Bangladesh, a country which has given us some of the greatest climate leadership. Geography makes Bangladesh very vulnerable to sea level rise and floods and horrific cyclones, but they are leading. Do you remember, listeners, when the late Dr. Salim ul Haq told us about how now, whenever there is an emergency, they have a sophisticated warning system, and it means that deaths are minimal. Shelters on higher land are there, people can go up with their livestock, and children are sent out to help elderly people get there. Young people with loud hailers go around door to door shouting out, you know, be warned. And he said to us, when hundreds of people were swept away in European floods, he said, I remember him saying this on air, how they could learn a lot from us. So we're here to learn from Runa Khan. Another Bangladeshi person I just want to put, because this is recent, the interim leader, who is the Nobel laureate Professor Muhammad Yunus. Remember, listeners, the Grameen Bank and his promotion of microfinancing. Well, now he has a big agenda to reverse the climate crisis with zero emissions and zero poverty. It's an economic shift away from high profits and catastrophic consequences. So among these stellar people, we've got Runa Khan now. She's part of a global climate leadership where Bangladesh is very prominent. We've spoken to her before about her organisation, Friendship. It started with hospital ships taking healthcare along the rivers to remote areas and during floods. But now Friendship has expanded from health to education to mangrove restoration, and they have won the 2025 Earthshot competition in a category called Fixing the Climate. So Runa Khan is with us to explain how this holistic work, taken to scale, will play a big part in climate action. So welcome, Runa. How are you?
Thank you very much, Vivian. I'm very pleased to be with all of you today and from Bangladesh.
Well, I'm so delighted for you being honoured in that way. You must still be walking on clouds, really. Can you tell us why Friendship was chosen in this category, Fixing the Climate?
Yeah, it's Fix Our Climate, and it's the Earthshot Prize. As you may know, that Prince William started this 5 years ago, and with a 10-year mandate for seeing how he could work with environment. And for me, it's very important, because it's not that it suddenly started and he wanted to do it. In the 70s, Al Gore and the then Prince Charles had already moved this agenda forward a lot. And so it is something which Prince William had taken, you know, he himself felt so deeply about it, and he wanted to do something about it, that he started this Earthshot Prize, remembering the Moonshot Prize of earlier, President Kennedy's Moonshot Prize. And I think, well, today, you know, it's known as the Nobel Prize of Climate, for Environment. And it's really an honor to get this. And possibly, you know, we have been chosen because Bangladesh is known for its adaptation solutions. And Friendship has been the one organization which started working in this category of adaptation solution, integrated, holistic climate adaptation solutions since the last 23 to 25 years. We started 25 years ago, 23 years, we launched the first hospital ships. And what we did was, over the years, made it into, every time a person, an intermigrant or a person migrates, we see that they become poorer and poorer till a time comes when, with every flood, with every cyclone, every river erosion, they lose everything and they have to restart their lives. And so we started holistic concepts of giving solutions and adaptation solutions where a person can be lifted from this poverty, ultra poverty line to, even when they migrate, to stand on their own feet and be able to understand their socio-economical, geographical, climatical ecosystem, and to work with nature. We have this adaptation model which addresses the full ecosystem of human needs, from health to habitats, education to energy, livelihoods to justice. And our model is community-led, it's nature-based, it's not theoretical, it's working at scale already, directly impacting and actually directly giving services to 7.5 million people annually. Like, we have done more than 10% of the health of Bangladesh, a country of 180 million people. And climate cannot be fixed in isolation, and Earth Shot recognized that the strength lies, in climate actions which are linked with dignity, local knowledge, in encompassing the biodiversity and the environment. And so we are not a pilot project. We are a project which has been working in this and creating impacts over the last 23 years.
Right. Well, look, the prize money was £1 million, but I think also part of the prize is contact with patrons, banks, businesses, people who are excited by the idea as it's explained to them. Listeners can look online and see little videos about the Friendship organization, but I think we need a really a word picture from you, how you're going to take it to scale, especially the mangrove, the
Yes.
sequestration of carbon in the mangroves all around the Bay of Bengal there, which listeners must know is so vulnerable to storms and so on. Tell us about that.
Yes, thank you. With the prize money, it's not only the money, it is Earthshot prize and what it brings with it. And you're absolutely right. It is linkages, it is expansion, it is filling in the gaps which are needed, not only nationally, but also to inspire internationally. And that is exactly what's already happening. And it's just incredible because we've just won the prize and already we are getting so many interests, not only from not only from patrons who may help us financially, but also from governments of different countries who are in this in climate crisis. The first Bangladesh is seventh in the list, and with the largest demography which will be impacted. But there are many small nation state, island states, large island states, which are also vulnerable. And we have so much dreams, of we look at the stars, but we have to keep our foot into the earth. And we will fill with this funding, friendships, interventions, and strengthen our work. And regarding the Sundarbans, as you know, that this is, Sundarbans are in Bangladesh, and it's two-thirds in Bangladesh, one-third in India, and it is the largest mangrove forest in the world. And mangrove sequestrates 8 times more carbon than and biodiversity than any other tropical forests. And this is what we would like to expand on, at least 1,500 acres, which is going to be about, 250 kilometers of mangroves along the coastal belt, hopefully by 2030 to 2032.
My knowledge of the Sundarbans is from the novels of Amitav Ghosh,
And that's
Amitabh Ghosh, yes.
Amitabh, yeah, and I've just imagined it. It's a UNESCO World Heritage place, but I can imagine it's very vast, full of biodiversity, full of food, really, if people could have it. But then lately in this century, we've been having incredible cyclones.
Yes.
There was one in 2007. This is Dr. Salimul Haque told us about this. It killed over 3,000 people.
Sidr.
Yeah,
Yeah,
and
it was Cyclone Sidr.
That's right. And it was, and the cyclones went at 240 kilometers an hour. And I'm saying this
Yes.
is kind of on Australia, we've just been having a cyclone too. And everyone's frightened of the possibilities that cyclones can just damage everything. All the Sundarbans were a lot damaged then, but 3,400 people as well. Then in the 2020, we had another one, a cyclone, Amphan. Only 10 people died, and the cyclone was the same velocity. So this is proof that you are honestly doing such a lot to protect people. And so this next thing of protecting those mangroves by planting more and, you know, shoring up that barrier against the wave surges is really, really important. So could you tell us about the kind of people? I saw films of women planting mangroves. It looks like it's an ongoing job. It's not something they can do once and forget about
No,
it.
that doesn't happen. So, Vivian, the mangroves, they are the front line of protection for a country like Bangladesh and for the island states. Bangladesh is only 5 meters on average above the sea level. So, can you imagine what is going to happen to these 180 million people? So, whatever we do for them, if we don't protect them, and the mangroves are the first barrier of protection. And the cyclones are, of course, destroying the trees, but also human habitats are also, shrinking from the north. The Sundarbans are shrinking, and they're becoming more and more human habitats because they need to live for day to day. We are still having a poverty level which is 60% of the people, 82 million people was identified as being poor and ultra poor just after the COVID. And these people need food daily. So the Sundarbans, we not only, the government is responsible for doing reforestation within the Sundarban forest, and the government does that along with, where cyclones impacts have happened, because
Yes.
Sundarban is a very restricted area. But beyond the Sundarban, just above, Bangladesh is the largest delta in the world. So you have kilometers of Sundarban, which is, which are mangroves, which were actually protecting the people. And those are all have been really devastated, not only with the cyclones, but with human habitation. So
Yes.
we need to ensure that the mangroves protect the people, they protect the embankment, they protect it against salinity, which, one small leak into a breakage of the embankment means hundreds and thousands of hectares getting saline and, getting salinity, and the biodiversity totally vanishes. And
Yeah.
these are the areas that we have taken responsibility on ourselves to reforest. So we need to work ensuring that those people who are getting livelihoods from the soil get an alternative livelihood. And we see wonder happening, really wonders. Like, for example, within 4 years, 5 years, people can harvest from the Sundarban itself. Because of the biodiversity, restoring the aquatic biodiversity, especially, with crabs and
Yes,
shrimps and
yes.
fish returning to the ecosystem. The embankments don't break, saving government money, saving land from getting saline, and areas which were bringing in, the air brings in desertification, looming desertification. And suddenly we see sandy banks suddenly becoming a tropical forest. And it's not that it has been dire. These are all impacts because of that one plantation. And the sea and in on the rivers and in the distributaries, suddenly we see fishermen after fishermen for shrimps and crabs, where they had totally vanished because the shrimps and crabs had vanished. So it's a, and then of course there's carbon sequestration, which is, as I said, 8 times more, you know, up to 8 times more than any other tropical forest. So planting a mangrove is a kind of you bring in such a holistic development of people and biodiversity and environment that it nothing beats it. And this is the work that we have taken on to ensure that we have protection for our people and they do not migrate, have to migrate with every storm.
Well, we're speaking to Runa Khan, founder of the Friendship NGO. Look, Runa, I believe you began as a teacher and a writer of textbooks way back, probably. I just read about that and I thought, I can imagine you were a teacher, of course. Tell us how your hospitals and schools are giving Bangladeshi people, especially women, a sort of a new textbook to live by, a new narrative, you know, that I'm sure there's a whole new ethos now with the people who work with you.
And you're totally, absolutely correct. Because, you know, working with the people when they have nothing except the clothes that they have on, starting with people to bring to them what is required, needs something which is not a tool only. You know, we need to work, first of all, giving back people their respect and, you know, self-respect and dignity. Because if they, in this movement, you know, when you're migrating, you're losing your thing, you're somebody a bit important, you have some cows and you've got a home and you've got a little farm or at least, you know, some place where economic returns are coming to you, and the next day you are totally left naked and barren. So we need to ensure that whatever we do, self-respect and dignity is the first thing that is restored to the people. And secondly, then comes, you know, ensuring food, health, and education is what brings them hope for tomorrow. And we have dismantleable schools, which can be, you know, dismantled when the river erosions happen, when a cyclone strikes and floods come in. They can be dismantled within a few hours and you know, again, put up within a day. And this is very important because this keeps a continuity to the lives of the children and also for our adult education, brings life for them, you know, a kind of gives them a continuity when they don't have continuity. And
Yes.
this experience by itself gives them mental strength and focus. So it is, our schools are not only academic centers. It's very important that we include the environment, socio-economic environment in our schools. So they are all a formal education because they all need a certificate and they cannot kind of get a job and go move on in life. So they have a certificate and then they go on to ensuring that they are linked with also international schools so that they can work online and they experience beyond their island. There are children who do not have never even seen a road because they don't have money to go across to the mainland. So they sit now today with their computers, which are all run by solar panels because there is no electricity here, and they are conversing with students internationally. And this experience kind of jump starts their life, their self-confidence, their knowledge, and it also gives them an understanding that they are someone and tomorrow they can be leaders in Bangladesh and be a voice of the communities who experience such climate movements internationally. And that
Yes.
is what we do.
Fantastic. Well, you've started with promoting health and education, and this thing about dignified work when these people planting mangroves, restoring habitats, and it's climate work. Tell us the connection between, I think Dr. Salimul Haq used to always tell us, Bangladeshi people really understand about climate change, partly from experience, but also because the journalists and, you know, your TV sessions, they mention it, they talk about it. In Australia, there's a lot of denial because, you know, we'd spend our time exporting gas and coal, so we kind of deny it. So you can see why we do. It's self-interest, but it's awful. And you are right in the front line there. What's the link between the, do the people feel they're taking climate action, these ones planting
Okay.
mangroves?
Actually, when you have to live, you have to live every day, and you are in a totally unpredictable ecosystem where you can lose your home, you can lose your life, you can lose your livelihood within hours. People, I do not like this term resilience so much because this absolves others from responsibility. Saying, the Bangladeshi people are very resilient. So I do not personally like this term being used. They are people who have managed with their strength to override their daily difficulties and their crisis. So they are a people who know how to address climate because that is their challenge, climate and subsequent poverty of that climate. And people need everything. Then, when you are suffering, you cannot go and talk to a person about planting trees. You have to ease that suffering first. So they are at a stage where they cannot even reach healthcare. So we had to start with health, ensuring people do not suffer and they can stand on their feet. And then comes the cyclones and the storms and the river erosion and salinity. We need to protect them from that with the mangroves as much as we can, preparing them that what they have to do, how they have to take care of the persons with disabilities, pregnant women, old women in their villages, how they have to start planting banana plants so then they can build rafts. Because when the cyclone and the erosion happens, no one is there to help them, We need to prepare them, and we do that. And then comes food, and how do they, from agriculture, how can they maximize agriculture? Keep food secure, at least have food security for the few days they have to live before relief can come in. We have to prepare them for all this. And then there is school. And at the end of all this is they need to understand where, when they migrate, is their ecosystem for the political ecosystem, how they can reach government centers, because they can be far away from our working area. And how they reach the government system, how and why they have to demand their rights from the government. These are very important, you see, because they are they feel alone, and we mustn't let that happen to millions of people. A country can never move upwards when they leave behind 60, 70 million people in the threshers and of facing a disaster daily.
When you compare an old growth forest compared to a forest which is regrowing after a disturbance like logging, they're actually quite different ecosystems. Generally, like older, wetter forests slow down the path of fire, and this is actually quite a well-known phenomenon. Historically, these big, large fires have been quite rare, but what we've seen in the last 20 years is they're becoming quite a lot more common. So we've had three in the last 20 years. This is definitely because of climate change, which is making our ecosystems a lot drier and the fire weather more intense.
3CR, your station in struggle and solidarity.
Jump online and give what you can. Go to 3cr.org.au.
We're speaking to Runa Khan, founder of the Friendship NGO. Well, Runa, you've just been to Brazil to receive your prize, but also you went to the climate conference in Belém, and we've been broadcasting about that. It's the most exciting conference. And I imagine a lot of things happened. There's always been the people who just give the headlines, oh, they were disappointed. But there's so much enthusiasm and energy, and there are so many people there. And the front headline that I, when I've interviewed people about, they said, we want to put forest restoration front and center and Indigenous people, protect the Indigenous people because they are the guardians of the forest. And it may be disappointing on some level, but in the discussions you had and the seminars you attended, what did you learn?
Well, first I learned that COPs will keep happening in spite of what they do. What happens at the COP? Here you have this COP, which is known as adaptation COP, a COP which is known as supposed to be the COP of truth. Of the truth, and we have this where we have it in a very difficult location to reach, to live in, For the civil society to be able to get a room where, you know, even Ibis hotels are $3,000 a night. So
what?
How do civil, how, yes, believe
really?
me. So yes. So how does civil society, why were we not protected for that, you know? But okay, fine. But we still have it in the, we still loved it because it was in the heart of the Amazon forest. And that is where civil society could really raise their voice, not only the indigenous people, because they were the frontliners here, but also all the countries, all the island states, all land which are through the desertification, all of them are people who are impacted by climate. So all of us had voices along with the indigenous people from the Amazons, and certainly protection. You see here, protection of indigenous people, because it was in the Amazon forest and it was in right thrusted in the face of all the fossil fuel companies, you know, who are arguing whether fossil fuel is 97% or 90% responsible for the climate, you know, for the emissions. I mean, you know, this is like incredible. And they're arguing on that. And here you have these hundreds and thousands of people impacted in the middle of a forest, and a lot more could have come out if Of from this COP, if in the COP we did not, we do not, I mean, this is not this COP only, because this COP, after all, in the end, okay, there have been the countries like Colombia, et cetera, which have really shown a lot of strength. Yes. And they have really moved, you know, the agenda ahead. But, you know, COP always comes out with very little agenda and very little follow-up and very little action. But the civil society, the learnings which they get between themselves, exchange which they have, is extremely important. And therefore, we should be present in the COPs, not kind of say, okay, it's only for the rich or it's only for the companies. Because the companies give money. You know, so therefore, everybody is pandering to the at the COP because they are getting sponsored. So something that the COP has to kind of, if you want to come to with a climate agenda, which can have a future of real action, we need to ensure that people give money without saying that they're giving money to it or something, you know.
Yes.
Somebody has to come up with a solution of not pandering to companies which are really, really harming this planet.
Yes. Oh, yes, I can see that. But as you said at the very beginning, a lot of people have contacted you since you got the Earthshot Prize. And these are not just rich donors or banks. These are also countries that are saying, we want to learn from you. We want to be allies with you. And I'm sure from now on, this is a fantastic networking opportunity. But I just want to keep thinking about the climate conference. The late Dr. Salim al-Haq often reported to us from those. He never gave up. I used to wonder, he looked so sad sometimes on the video, you know, how can he bear to go through all this stuff? He was there in Glasgow and all of that. He was a friend to our radio too. He would always talk to us and to the small island states, you know, and he felt Bangladesh had a lot to teach. Do you find a willingness to learn from you? When you were at the COP, did you find people who wanted to be allies? They wanted to learn from your model?
So, you know, I think, you know, Dr. Professor Salim al-Haq was very dear to us, and he was an advisor also on our board in for environment in, you know, in Bangladesh. And he, for me, he has been one of the world environmentalists always.
Yes.
And it was that, you know, but we are action driven in our organization. We are really action driven. So, you know, in spite of Bangladesh having, you know, in the 71 cyclone, more than a million people had died. And as you know, in Amphan, only a few. But it's not only every life matters, but it has been really, really controlled. But it needs so much more. It needs so much more, because the last lines, as you know, of the erosion, for example, people communicate. We have a very good system in Bangladesh, and they communicate, but they communicate to the districts. What about that last 10 kilometer to reach that island, that 30 kilometers to reach that island, because that island may not be there, you know, after the erosions. So there is a lot of work still to be done for me. There is a lot of work still to be done for reaching the last miles. And if you don't want to leave people behind, it's not only divisional heads who just because they know that actions happen. And in this way, I'm just very practical. You know?
Yes.
And we regarding adaptation, I tell you, Vivian, I mean, you see, there are many kinds of migrants which are going to happen, which are already happening. There are intra-migrants within the country. There are migrants who will become political refugees tomorrow because they'll go out of the country. And you're going to have another kind of climate migrants, people who are not prepared, and that is the northern countries. Countries who have everything today, the first world countries. Their migrancy will be of a different kind because they will not know how to handle things when a disaster happens. And if they are not prepared and they do not see, you know, there is going to be migrancy of a different level. There's going to be, you know, you can have the richest person in the world. If he is impacted with a hurricane and tornado and his house is blown off and his kids are no longer with him, he is a migrant in his mind then.
Mm.
And this is the migrancy which I am afraid can happen to the first world countries and to the North if they do not, and, you know, companies and the rich people of the world who do not yet, they kind of see climate. I cannot believe people can be so blind that they don't see what's happening, but they are driven by greed. They are driven by wanting more and more and more. And for what? Not for their children, because for their children, they need to leave a world which is still there. People and the world as we know it, which is still there. The world will survive, planet will survive, but biodiversity, environment, and life as we know it will not survive. And this is what, you know, their greed today, it will impact the people of tomorrow and their own children and grandchildren of tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, this brings me to my last question, which is about values. When we last met on Zoom, both you and Dr. Selimul Haque spoke very compassionately about the 1 million Rohingya refugees. I was very touched by both of you saying, oh, this is terrible, these poor people, we will accommodate them, which is not the way it is in Australia with refugees. You know, we have a very hard part here about refugees, I'm sorry to say. But you both said that then. And those people are still coming, I've read, you know, from Myanmar, still in conflict, they're still coming. And climate change, as you said, is creating more refugees.
Yes.
And I know Friendship is supported by people who are not so much donors. You always talk about them as partners in what I think is a very long-term project. It's a lifelong project to save our future. Like, it's a century-long project. It's longer than that even. So speak to the listeners who want to take effective climate action. Speak to them about the values that you look for in partners.
You know, I started the NGO not even understanding what an NGO was. So what drove me to start was just empathy, compassion, frustration, anger at the fact that we were not doing enough. And this is, we in Bangladesh ourselves are not doing enough. This is, you know, for the climate impactees. So over the last 23 years, we have been trying our best, and we say partners because, you know, the way this needs to be addressed is not one particular way. Anything like money, like a certain way of building a boat or housing them or bringing them food, these are all tools. These are tools which has to be changed depending on what exactly. Is it desertification? Is it river erosion or floods? You know, two totally different things. Or is it snow? So these are tools which we have to use, and we need to have partners who understand that the tools are not the same for every environment, every socio-economic, geo-political ecosystem, you know? And this is why, first of all, we speak of partners. The values that we work with is we do not run after expansion of programs. Programs need to, every life we touch matters to us. And because of that, there have often been cases where there have been millions of dollars that we have said no to because we did not think that impact would happen and it would just be a waste of time. And perhaps it is because of this today that our work is so strong because the roots of the work is based on the five values that we have. And we do not compromise on these values, you know. And these are like integrity, dignity, justice, quality, hope. And people often say, you know, integrity. Integrity from our side, integrity to our donors, right to the people we touch. Dignity, because dignity, respect is the most important thing. When the Rohingyas came in, all I wanted our staff to do was, I said, you know, ensure that they have lost everything. Ensure that they don't lose their self-dignity again and again and again. Treat them with so much humanity and respect. Do not, you know, for example, when we give relief, we go to the people and give relief. We don't want them wading through water and coming to us. We wade through the water and go and give them the relief. So there are ways. You are only giving them a bag of rice, you know, or something, you know, which is okay, a little better than that. But, you know, but if you take away more than what you give to them, and you do that if you take away their dignity and self-respect. And for the Rohingyas, possibly today, this is why we are the largest in health in the camps and second or third largest in education. We were doing everything in the beginning and then we concentrated where others had gaps. People need empathy, compassion, listening to. These are, you know, a migrant is today a migrant. Tomorrow he might, you know, he might have enough strength to become a leader. And then a political leader, and then the voice for the world. Give him that opportunity by having faith in him. And we need to have faith in the people who are today migrants, tomorrow would be leaders of this world, you know, and we need to have faith in them.
Thank you. Well, thank you from the bottom of my heart, Runa, from talking to us. It's always inspiring. And I'm so glad you got that prize to honor you internationally. I know you don't have too much time to do promotion, but truly, I hope other people will take your story far and wide. We're very lucky to have heard about friendship today. And listeners, it's called Friendship. It starts with a ship, but it's all these other things that are now part of climate action. And so please tell us again another time, but thank you for speaking to us today.
Thank you very much, Vivian. It was absolutely a pleasure. And we can, of course, discuss academic means and ways and give you more insight, which is always possible. So we're always there and for Australia.
That was Runa Khan, founder of Friendship and winner of the 2025 Earthshot competition in the category called Fixing Our Climate. Thank you, Runa.
My name's Darryl Best. I worked all my working career in coal mines. I am now passionate about a transition to renewables and about saving our planet. And you are listening to the Climate Action Radio Show on Community Radio. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
We heard about the Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh from Runa Khan. Next door neighbour Myanmar continues what the UN describes as ethnic cleansing against civilians and genocide. If we drill a bit deeper, Rakhine State holds oil and gas fields which produce 20 million cubic metres of climate-changing gas per day. It's mostly exported to China in the Sino-Myanmar pipeline. Thus, China can bypass the Straits of Malacca by using ports in Rakhine State. It's a key area in the Belt and Road project. Does it sound familiar? Genocide. Oil and gas. Economic interests. This takes us to Gaza, where offshore gas is also a factor in the horror story that has seen Gaza crushed since 2023. Here is Mr. Shamik Badra speaking at a public meeting at Green Left offices in Sydney this year. It was a meeting in connection with the Rising Tide Climate Action Group, and you will hear how they are in solidarity with Palestine and against the Australian export of coal to Israel.
Last night, I met a family in Gaza who came to Sydney, and I was in discussion. I want to update to know the details about the situation. And they told me the situation became so dangerous after the genocide. And they are talking about things people, perhaps media are not interested or didn't cover that in the media, like the children were talking how the sewage water, like, were in the tents everywhere, especially when it's raining, then the sewage with water mixed together, which is so dangerous. They reminded me about the situation regarding how the bodies, the dead bodies in the streets everywhere, because no one, and it's not easy to bury them, and how the dogs, cats, rats, like, eating their bodies. This is so dangerous about the environment and about the smell of these bodies. And I remember some people told me, you are lucky that you found someone to bury your father in this genocide. Otherwise, the cats and dogs can eat his body. So we are talking about terrible situation regarding affect not only about human beings, also affect the environment in general. White phosphorus. I remember when I was in Gaza how they were bombed by phosphorus. It was burning human flesh, burning trees, burning soil. Like, it make farmland unusable. It poison water. It stays in the environment for years. This is not just war, it's ecocide. Now, during this genocide, Israel has bombed greenhouses and farms. Thousands of animals have died, not only from bombs, but from hunger and thirst. There is no food, no water, no plants left. Even if there are, if there is water, it's not clean. It's terrible. You can't imagine now there is no trees. Then I asked my friends, they told me no trees, because people, Palestinians, forced to cut these trees in order to make food and to make fire to in this cold weather. Everything destroyed in Gaza. It's important to focus also about the bodies under the rubbles. A lot of people were under the rubbles, around 15 or to 20,000 under the rubbles, their body under the rubbles. They didn't pass away quickly. It took time to pass away. My brother and his family were one of these people who were under the rubbles. And behind it all, gas. Gas fields lie just off the coast of Gaza. This war is also a war of control of land and resources for domination of the Middle East environment and economy. That's why struggle for Palestine is a part of the climate struggle. Because environmental justice means fighting colonialism. Because the Israeli occupation doesn't just target people, it targets Earth itself. It destroys land, trees, and seas. And the sea, it destroys any possibility of life. And the Western countries support Israel, especially America, with bombs, with money, and they are silenced and protect Israeli occupation. This is what imperialism look like. But I am here with hope, because around the world, people are waking up. Palestine Solidarity is now the largest sustained anti-war movement in history. Many of you support the Freedom Flotilla not launched by Palestinians, but by activists, some of them climate activists, including Greta Thunberg, who see Palestine as a part of the same fight. These activists brought food and baby medicine from Yola, not weapons. They stood for life, for environment justice, for Gaza children, for the world where no child is poisoned by war, by pollution, or by poverty. So today I want to ask, how do we build common goals and common struggles? How do we make sure that environmental justice means justice for Palestinians too? How do we join forces across oceans, across movements, to fight for a world where no child is bombed and no land is poisoned? This is not justice about Gaza. It's about all of us. If we stay silent while bombs fail on children, while water is poisoned, while trees and farms are burned, then we are allowing this destruction to continue. But we are not silent. We are here to say enough is enough. Palestinians deserve life, safety, and dignity like anyone else in the world. The earth deserves to be protected and not destroyed by war. There can be no climate justice without justice for Palestine, no peace without freedom, no future without decolonization. Let's stand together for life, for land, for liberation. Let's build this struggle together. Thank you.
I'm saying I would like to hear what the evidence is that we are shipping coal to Israel. On top of all of our other sins, that we're doing that as well. I find it unbelievable, but I'm sure you're going to tell me why it's believable.
It's Michael West Media. On March 26, 2025, the article's called "Trade in a Time of Genocide, Our Exports to Israel Are Growing Fast." And just to give you an idea, just a little bit further down, it mentions, and this is backed up figures, right? Coke, coal, briquettes, $29 million. And the next biggest is chemicals, $4.5 million. So it's our largest export. Coal is our largest export to Israel. So, you know, anyway, read that article. That's it.
We also had a Palestinian flotilla in 2023. And what that was a whole bunch of us on the canoes in the water, flying the flag and making popular what Greta Thunberg said very clearly. As she started to get very involved in the Palestine solidarity movement, she said there is no climate justice on colonized lands. And she really came out very strong. She got a lot of a blowback from the Zionists, and she kept organizing. And Rising Tide, to its credit, when Greta Thunberg was on the Gaza flotilla, put all of Greta's comments on their social media and made it really clear that they stood side by side with the Gaza flotilla. So because of Kelly Tranter and Declassified Australia's very good research into coal exports to Israel, we have found out there's been a 12% increase in the last year from Australia to Israel. Not all of that's through Newcastle ports, but there is an increase, and there is an increase from South Africa as well. The South African government is also very good at hyperbole and statements, and they have been better in some actions than the Australian government. But yeah, I think we're actually at a very good point to try and mobilize the environment movement, Palestine movement, to say no coal to Israel. And in fact, the South African boycott, divest and sanctions movement is asking Australia, the environment and unions to move with them on a joint campaign. And I think Rising Tide, with its good politics, we can make that intersection. So yeah, Greta Thunberg also said, we've got to keep trying. We have to make the movement bigger. We've got to keep trying. So all of these ideas are really important.
This is 10 years worth of organizing. So what you're seeing now is a history of trial and error of how to get there. If I'm correct, it's almost been 10 years. So the people, it started in Newcastle, and the two main people there, they have a history of activism like yourself, and they're from groups like Get Up, and they had a lot of political education as well. And they've created a pretty much of a handbook, like a 101 of how you can actually start it. But talking about my experience and how I entered it, it was through small groups. It wasn't like these like big events. It was actually word of mouth and speaking to friends. And I went to a deep ecology, talking about intersection again. Deep ecology is the soft part, the vulnerable part, the fertile part of activism, where it's the behavior shifts. And I met a lot of the main organizers. And then they have these affinity groups where you have like 5 or 10 friends where you come together and you talk about these things. And it's exactly what you're saying. It starts with a discussion. Yeah. And then the next better step, not the best step, and then you attend and you show up. You have an intention to show up. We go to the meetings. We go to this. We put our hand up for events like that. You know, Najin is, I go to uni together and I talk to her and she's come along. So it's first that, and then I bring them to the organizing meetings where the people that have been around for much longer, like Liz, guide us. So it's an intergenerational, intercultural thing that happens. A takeaway, because I know I talked a lot, for you would be like you and I exchanging an email straight after this and then attending tomorrow an event that is UNSW and Rising Tide that we're doing tomorrow. And that is how it builds a momentum. And then Rach is here from Socialist Alliance, and that builds like these bubbles, these webs that I was talking about of life, this interconnectedness. We talk about capitalism as being the enemy. I'm gonna look at the other spectrum and talk about that radical interconnectedness that is deep within Buddhism, that radical interconnectedness. When you're talking about your family, I felt your grief, and that's that radical interconnected we have as humans, you know, as more than humans, to animals as well. So yeah, I'm kind of a bit rambling, but yeah, that's sort of where it comes from.
The Climate Action Team would like to thank Only Just for their financial support of this program. Only Just sources high quality, fair trade goods and gifts from artisans in over 25 developing countries, showcasing partners that use traditional skills and modern designs to create beautiful goods through ethical and sustainable practices. Discover their unique range, onlyjust.com.au, or visit their Eltham store in the Eltham Village Shopping Centre on Main Road. It's Only Just.
Newcastle Harbour was filled with an exuberant flotilla of people from all over Australia this weekend. It is the greatest coal exporting port in the world, and their big demand this year is for Australia to tax coal export profits. Tax should be 78%, according to them, and it's based on Norway's 78% tax on its oil and gas sector. But the main cry is for no new coal and gas projects. This is a challenge to the Albanese Labor government. They have a solid majority and a mandate from the public to take serious climate action, yet they've signed off on 31 new coal and gas projects since 2022. As the Nature Journal Climate Action found, we can see a direct connection between every additional ton of CO2 emissions to heat deaths and global warming. Government's own climate risk assessment this year showed how new coal and gas costs lives and bleaches coral and ruins habitat and makes us frightened, doesn't it? This last cyclone in the north, you know, it was terrifying. Palm trees bent down to the ground. So we'll have more courage and inspiration from Newcastle next time. But to finish, here is Amy Robertson in Belém at the big UN climate conference, COP30. She's from Cultural Survival International.
Halito Ankana, hello friends. I am Amy Robertson, the Executive Director of Cultural Survival, and we're here on Amazonian indigenous lands in Belém do Pará, Brazil. The Brazilian government has called this the COP of Truth, but in reality, thousands of indigenous peoples have been denied access to the Blue Zone, where negotiations are happening and decisions are being made that will undoubtedly impact indigenous communities and territories disproportionately, just as climate change does. But we're here in support of and solidarity with indigenous peoples, leaders, women, and youth who are demanding that their voices be heard through demonstrations, through marches, through site events and panels, asking for real climate solutions, rejecting false solutions, asking for demarcation of their territory so that they can continue to be the good stewards of biodiversity and carbon sequestration through the ecosystems that they care for. We're here to follow the action, to make sure their voices are heard. Today is actually the Indigenous Day of Action at COP, so there'll be more to come. And while it's unclear where the negotiations are going, the U.S., the largest climate polluter in the world, even failed to send a delegation, and there are reports that 1 in 25 delegates from around the world are actually oil and gas lobbyists. One thing is crystal clear. We don't know what the world will commit to, but we know indigenous peoples are committed to real change, are committed to securing life for the future of all humanity and life on Mother Earth. Indigenous peoples have the wisdom and the solutions to offer the world. So please follow along with us on our social media, sign up for our newsletter on culturalsurvival.org or cs.org, and Chipinta Lachiki, we'll see you soon.
Peoples. There is no climate future without Indigenous peoples. We need to demand the recognition of the rights of Indigenous peoples in all aspects of negotiations. Indigenous rights now.
We are the people.
We are the people.
We have the power.
We have the power.
We will not be silenced.
We will not be silenced.
We are the people.
We are the people.
We have the power.
Thank you to Runa Khan and her staff member, Kim, who helped me connect with Bangladesh. Thank you to Mr. Sharmik Bhadra and the Rising Tide people at the Green Left public meeting this year, and to Amy Robertson and Cultural Survival at COP30 in Belém. My name is Vivian Langford. Goodbye and good luck.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared. It's coal. It's coal. It's coal.
Tune in every Monday at 5 p.m. to hear the Climate Action Radio Show.
Breaking news. Here's Kelly O'Shaughnessy from the Australian Conservation Foundation with her first reaction to the new environment laws passed today, which give extra protections to forests.
So this very day last year, we lost the nature protection laws in the parliament, and we were rightfully feeling a bit glum. But I knew that we would win the laws that we have just won 1 year later today for two reasons. The first is we never, ever, ever give up, because when you're asking for big, bold, lasting change, you're going to lose a few times before you win. But the second reason I knew we would win is because we've got you in our team. So to every single person who has signed a petition, written to their MP, knocked on their MP's doors, taken your neighbours and your friends and your community groups to ask our MPs to do better, thank you so much. I think today we've just shown that the power of the people is greater than the people in power. Never forget that.